And you can find out more on The One Show tonight, including some very exciting details about the Royal Seal of Approval for the whole thing. Ooh, what a tease.
Excellent. Right. Still loads to come on Drive. We're going to keep you up to date with the cricket not going too well for England at the moment. And old Dry Keith, we're going to celebrate his legacy in China, where he made the world's most boring sandwiches and became something of a celebrity. We'll talk about him later.
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
The headlines, though, at 5 o'clock on Drive. Sir Keir Starmer has delivered his first speech as Prime Minister to the Labour Party conference, promising to rebalance the country for working people. He told delegates in Liverpool he would restore the belief for families that their children would grow up in a country that was getting better. But as our political correspondent Alex Forsyth explains, much of the speech focused on the idea that people would have to accept tough choices.
He was talking about if you want new renewable energy, you might have to have pylons built on above ground. If you want more prison places, you might have to have new prisons built near your home. If you want more homes overall, there's going to have to be house building in every community. So it was this kind of message, the shared struggle that he was trying to convey. But I think he was also trying to set out, obviously, his vision for what then would come next.
Israel says it has killed a senior Hezbollah commander in an airstrike in Beirut. The Israeli military said Ibrahim Mohamed Kubesi was the commander of the militant group's missile and rocket force, responsible for launching missiles into Israel. It said other Hezbollah commanders were also present when the attack took place. Earlier, the Lebanese health ministry said 6 people had been killed and 15 others injured in the Israeli strike on a residential building in the south of the city. Joe Biden has told world leaders there's still time to contain the growing military conflict in the Middle East. He's been delivering his last speech to the United Nations as president.
Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest. Even if the situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is still possible. In fact, it remains the only path to lasting security to allow the residents from both countries to return to their homes and the border safely. And that's what we're working tirelessly to achieve.
In the last few minutes, British Airways has said that it's suspending flights to and from Israel till Friday at the earliest. The airline said it would be contacting customers to advise them of their travel options. TSB's apologised to customers for a glitch, which meant many didn't receive their wages or benefits this morning. It says the problem is now fixed and all affected accounts have been credited. And a police disciplinary panel has heard how a Leicestershire police officer was arrested at Stansted Airport after calling in sick to go on a week-long holiday. Rajar Khan was arrested in October after returning from Turkey. The Independent Office for Police Conduct said he would have been dismissed from the force but had since resigned. That is the news. Jonathan McKee's got the sport.
Tony, thank you. England's cricketers are chasing 305 to win and keep the ODI series alive against Australia. But as we heard before the news, it's not going to plan, Ellie Aldroyd.
No, both England's openers falling to Mitchell Starc in the same over. Phil Salt for a duck and then Ben Duckett for 8. Caught by Glenn Maxwell, fairly straightforward catch, and you just had a feeling at that stage that the wobble was started. But Will Jacks and Harry Brook are sticking in there for the moment. 23 for 2 England after 5 overs, and the target is 305 to beat Australia and stay in this series.
Thank you, Elliot. Commentary from Durham on Five Sports Extra. AFC Wimbledon's managing director, James Woodruff, has told Drive it's too early to say what the scale of the damage to the club's pitch is following the flood that forced tonight's EFL Cup match against Newcastle to be postponed. Over 100,000 litres of water had to be pumped out of the club's stadium at Plough Lane after a nearby river burst its banks. And Wolves defender Yerson Mosquera is expected to miss the rest of the season with the knee injury he sustained at Aston Villa earlier this month. More at 5:30.
A look at your travel. It's not doing too badly on the motorways at the moment. It's mostly the usual places. The M8 in Glasgow heading west at 13, joining the M80 at Brabant. We've got emergency repairs there, so a couple of lanes are closed. It's heavy on the M3 in Hampshire. Repairs going on there as well, with one lane closed at Winchester South, Junction 11, and the A421. So that's south or southwest of Bedford, but it's around the, it looks like it's the Marshallese roundabout, the A6, the Branston Way. So they've closed the road off and it's in both directions, but it's affecting you heading to and from the M1 at Junction 13 as well. Tower Bridge in London is now closed for an accident, so nothing getting through in both directions there. And the A2 in Eltham in London, westbound, is blocked by an accident near the Falconwood interchange. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
Cheers, Orna. Thanks very much indeed. We'll have the latest from Lebanon before the end of the programme. We're going to speak to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Also, we'll speak to a Labour MP shortly about the the Labour conference. And you've been speaking, Holly, to John Attenborough.
An
amazing character.
A really amazing guy. He set himself a challenge. He's partially visually impaired, and he set himself the challenge to go around all 42 SPFL pitches in Scotland. And he ticked the last one off at the weekend there. He made it to Forfar, was the final one, to a brilliant reception. He got an award, and just such a remarkable achievement. I think what he's achieved from this is more than getting a trophy or a medal, but it's encouraging other people with disabilities to come to the football, to get involved and realise that it's for them, it's for everybody.
Yes, so that's still to come. Thanks for all your texts to the show. Pet remedies, amongst other things. We spoke to a cobbler earlier on. You'll be kicking yourself if you... I didn't mean that, no pun intended, if you missed it. He made shoes for a camel. So we're looking at pet remedies or things, aids for pets. Ben says, I had a large flat roof man cave. Pigeons used to sit on it and wind my Jack Russell up. So I put a 12-foot scaffold board ramp from ground to roof so the Jack Russell could run up there and chase them off.
I love that. Again, it's so convoluted, but it's...
She spent most of her time on the roof peering into neighbours' gardens. That's another thing.
Jack Russell probably shouting at them as well, let's be honest.
I am not reading the text out about eating a camel.
Do you know what?
Who's okayed that to be read?
I really can't believe how many inappropriate texts about camels that it's possible to get.
Exactly,
we really open the floodgates there.
If you've got a clean one, send us. I have met a camel and they're thin on the ground. People have met camels at the moment. Keep it clean. Come on, Ollie's only on day two. Don't show me up, for goodness sake. 85058.
They're making us laugh anyway.
Yeah. 85058 or WhatsApp is 0808 599 693.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni: pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV Licence Uni.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Good afternoon, Tony and Holly here with you until 7 o'clock. And the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has been delivering the keynote speech at the Labour Party conference with a promise to rebalance the country for working people.
The work of change has begun. The patient, calm, determined era of politics as service has begun. Planning reformed, doctors back in theatre, new solar projects, new offshore wind projects, the onshore ban lifted, Great British Energy launched, one-word Ofsted judgments ended, a border security command, a national wealth fund getting Britain building again, the renters reform bill stopping no-fault evictions, and the railway services bill bringing railways back into public ownership. And we're only just getting started. A crackdown on knife crime, a real living wage, a modern industrial strategy, a 10-year plan for our NHS, devolution to our nations, regions and cities, the biggest levelling up of workers' rights in a generation, more teachers, more neighbourhood police, more operations, rebuilding our public services. Change has begun.
As you might imagine, he touched on a range of issues. There was a pledge to house homeless veterans, care leavers and domestic abuse victims. And there was a promise to introduce what's called a Hillsborough Law by the time of the next anniversary of the 1989 disaster in April. And as with all good speeches, there were some viral moments as well, of course. On one occasion, the Prime Minister managed to trip over quite an unfortunate word.
I call again for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The return of the sausages, the hostages.
Well, the BBC's deputy political editor, Vicky Young, is at the conference in Liverpool. Afternoon, Vicky.
Hi there.
Well, let's move away from sausages for the time being. I can hear the music's turned down now anyway, and the delegates are probably making their way out. At this point now, after all the clapping is finished, what's been the overall reaction to the Prime Minister's speech?
Well, I think, as you would imagine, the people in the room absolutely loved it. And I think part of that was it was reminding them, look, Labour won the election. So, look, there's been a few problems since, but, you know, the big picture, here he was as the first Labour Prime Minister for very many years addressing the conference. And I think there was, you know, a bit of a recalibration, certainly in the tone. We've had a lot of people here, you know, worried about the doom and gloom, obviously warning that it's going to be very difficult. But, you know, there was a bit more hope, really. It was a sort of state of the nation, talking about national renewal, but saying it's going to take a very long time and that there will be some tough decisions in the short term. So I think laying out what he saw as the problems and firmly blaming the Conservatives for many of those, but also setting out a bit more of a picture of what he wants to change over the coming years. Of course, the missing bit is exactly how we get there. There is a budget coming up, and I think that's been, in a way, the timing of that budget has what's been causing a few of the problems for the party. There's this huge gap between getting elected and then we're still not going to get the budget until the end of October. And of course, in between, that leaves a lot of people guessing about what's going to come, with him warning there's going to be a lot of pain. So, you know, I think that's made the atmosphere, you know, maybe not as celebratory as you might have imagined.
Yeah, that's been some of the criticism today has been around that. The idea he's talked about change beginning, but we don't really know what it looks like. But what do you think he wanted to leave us with? You know, it sort of took a while to get there, but he was punchy on things like immigration, and we talked about the Hillsborough law. What were some of the key points that he wanted to leave us with?
Yeah, and I think sort of one of the passages that really stuck out was where he talked about the trade-offs. And I mean, he's talked a lot about, you know, basically calling for everyone to be patient about it, saying he wants to be different from the previous Conservative governments, and then talking about the trade-offs that there will have to be, which is saying, you know, you can't just be a populist, that you're going to upset some people as you go along. So, you know, if you're going to be tough on crime, which he says he wants to be, that means you've got to have more prisons. Now, lots of people don't want to be living near a prison, but some people will have to. In the same way that he's talking about green energy, that will mean more pylons across the landscape. Lots of people won't like that. If you're going to build more houses for people, that's more housing estates. And we've heard a lot about NIMBYs, haven't we? So sort of saying to people, look, I'm prepared to be unpopular. And actually, the sort of issues he's had in the last few weeks, I think sort of saying, look, that doesn't mean anything to me. He talked about it being more mere glitter on a shirt cuff, which is a reference back to last year when a protester threw glitter over his head. So I think him there saying, look, I'm going to be tough and I'm not going to be necessarily popular, and we're going to have to go through some difficult times. But in the end, he says he can see a vision and it will rebuild public services and make for a better country, he says.
Yeah, there are definitely a few pre-scripted lines in there referencing, you know, last year, 2019. And what was interesting, given, as of course, he's heading to the UN General Assembly now, that it was very light on foreign policy. He did call for restraint on the border between Lebanon and Israel. But other than that, not an awful lot.
No, not really. I mean, he has done quite a lot on the world stage, and I think he's very mindful of the fact he's literally about to fly off to New York in the next couple of hours. So, you know, tomorrow he will be out there with a lot of journalists, and, you know, that will definitely be the approach. You know, he's been to America a couple of times already. You know, he's talked a lot about Ukraine. He's had a European political summit. So he's been to Italy. You know, so I think he probably feels he's done a lot of that. This was very much more, you know, the domestic agenda and, you know, talking, of course, to the wider country, but I think a lot to the people in the room and, you know, talking about how he's going to approach things. And including, again, talking about the trade-offs, but, you know, for people in the room, talking about wealth creation, saying that's going to be part of it, about partnering with the private sector. Now, that's not what some people in the room want to hear, but him saying he's going to be pragmatic. He will do what it takes to improve the situation.
Yeah, a lot of people now will be looking for action and less talking. But in what he has said today and what he's laid out and given All the chat over the last couple of days and weeks about clothes and all the rest of it, do you think he's drawn a line underneath all of that?
Well, look, I think he's trying to. I think they're trying to say that it's not the most important issue. But I think the problem he has got is there were quite long passages about trust in politics and actually talking about how people are fed up with politics after everything that's happened over the last few years. So, you know, it is difficult for him. I think the idea that they're seen to be taking freebies, and this isn't just about him, actually. This is much broader. Politicians of all parties do that. It that doesn't, it doesn't quite strike true, does it, I think, with some of the things he's saying. So I think he's got to be a bit careful about it. But they, you know, I think they will think that there are much bigger issues to be dealt with. And the budget coming up is going to be a massive moment for his new government.
Yeah, absolutely. The BBC's deputy political editor, Vicky Young, thank you. Let's speak now to Sadiq Al-Hassan, who is the Labour MP for North Somerset. Sadiq, you were in the hall as the Prime Minister was delivering his speech. What did you make of it?
I honestly was so happy to hear him lay out his vision for a rebuilt Britain. I mean, we are going to address some of the fundamental problems with fairness in our society. And we're 11 weeks in, so we have accomplished more in these 11 weeks than I've seen from the last government for 11 years. So actually, when people are saying, you know, we want action, we've already started delivering it. And, proud to hear Keir lay out.
And which things are you most proud of in terms of what's being delivered?
Do you know what? Railway reform is fantastic. Looking at workers' rights with a new workers' new deal. Some of the things that, you know, we're speaking to are fixing the problem where people actually in this country don't feel that if they try hard, they will succeed. And, you know, that is a problem as a country. But also, we're fixing our reputation on a global stage. We are showing that Britain is open for business, but is also going to continue to honour our international obligations and act as a responsible country. So people can have confidence, especially business, that they can invest in Britain again. Because when you look at some of the problems that we've faced over the last 14 years, a lot of it comes from confidence, because business never knew what the Conservative government was going to do next. So actually, this kind of long-term planning, right, this strategy for how industry is going to evolve over the next decade and rebuilding the foundations with fairness mixed into it will make a better society where we can start to enjoy the benefits. So the benefits of growth.
So you talk about long-term planning. Can you understand frustration from some people, and particularly those who did vote Labour, that they don't feel that they've seen and heard enough? And do you think that Keir Starmer did enough this afternoon?
I don't think that's a fair thing to say 11 weeks in when we've just had 14 years of Conservative chaos and ruin. So, I mean, if you look at what we've inherited, and, you know, everybody who wakes up in the morning knows that, you know, our public services are broken. We can't fix things overnight. And I think we've been completely fair throughout the entire of our campaign, saying that this is going to be a decade of renewal. And, you know, so people who want things to fix immediately, we're going to have to, you know, keep building these foundations to make sure that where we go to will be the path that we want to deliver of a fairer Britain.
And that's probably what people wanted to hear more of, perhaps, in the speech, more details. And obviously, you know, we've got the budget just a couple of weeks away, and people are very intrigued to hear the content of that, because there are goals that we're being supplied with, but not so much in the details of how we get there.
No, I mean, I completely understand. But we also came into government in July, and we have to open the books and kick the tyres, so to speak, to understand, you know, when you walk into a department, what are actually the problems, the systems, what? And then there's the internal discussion about where those priorities balance in the national framework of the budget. So actually, you know, it would be unrealistic for us to walk in on the 4th of July and say, right, here's the budget, because there's so many things we need to see the actual books for. Right? Because, I mean,
you've seen them now.
Yeah, we have. And that's why we're now in that process of finding out why, with the interdepartment budgets, the discussions between departments about how all that fits together for the framework for, you know, this year and then the years going forward. Because, you know, this isn't just going to be the budget that, you know, is for this year. It's also going to set the framework for what we do going forward over the next 5 years and the 10-year plan for how we're going to deliver. Because if you look at the beginning of our journey here, if we make an intervention at this point, it can actually put us on a completely different path earlier on. So we have to make sure we pick the right choices and the right interventions to get us where we need to be as a country, where working people are rewarded for doing an amazing job, where people know that we have trust in the British people to deliver, and Britain as a country.
But what we have heard so far, there is a sense that these are still very broad brushstrokes. And just to give you a sense of what's coming in on text, I mean, we had people saying, yes, Keir Starmer's speech was uplifting, realistic, grown up and honest. But the other side of that was people saying, look, it was disappointing, very blame game, didn't inspire. Someone else says, awful, awful stuff. What did he say? Nothing. Sounded like a hustings.
Well, no. I completely disagree because, I mean, it's really easy to paint it as a two-sided picture, but I only saw the one side, which is Keir Starmer.
You're a Labour MP, so of course you do.
Of course. Well, you know, but I'm saying I'm right there, and I was saying Keir presented a professional view of a prime minister, something, you know, that will, you know, show Britain on a global stage as a country that is moving forward instead of looking consistently at the past with, you know, no policies that can actually deliver the change people need. We are now looking at fundamentally building those foundations so that the country works again, because it doesn't at the moment. We've inherited a country that doesn't work. So, of course, we have to fix it. And, of course, it's going to take time. So I completely disagree when you say that there's a two-sided story to this. It's very easy to present it as that. But people have had 14 years of failure from a Conservative government.
So some might argue that you've had 14 years to prepare for this.
It's easy to prepare, but it's very hard to actually do when you look in the departments and you see we have unfunded spending commitments and agreements within departments that no one ever thought would ever come to pass. And let's look at, you know, what we've inherited. Everybody knows it's a bad situation and we do need to fix it. So the idea that we can just immediately form a budget is completely unrealistic, and I think you know that.
Sadiq Al-Hassan, the Labour MP for North Somerset, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The time is 21 minutes, exactly, past five.
Yes, who knows? The cricket might be over by now. Yeah. England were playing so wearily earlier on. Let's go to Chester Street. Alan Oldroy's watching their reply to Australia's 304. Hello, Ellie.
Hello. Yes,
are we still playing?
Yes, we are still
playing.
Oh, good,
just checking.
Don't give up quite so soon, for goodness
well, you know
sake.
Me.
I know I was feeling a bit gloomy before. England have rebuilt a bit through Will Jackson, Harry Brook. They are 43 for 2 currently, and we're in the 10th over. Jackson's on 22, and Brook is on 11. So, yeah, losing both Phil Salt and Ben Duckett to one Mitchell Starc over was a bit of a blow for England, it would be fair to say. But they have settled things down a little bit. They are going to have to start putting the pedal down a bit if they're going to try and get up with the rate, though. They're going at around 4.5 and over, and the required rate now is 6.5. But rebuilding is obviously the key, and you've got a bit more time in the 50-over game than you have in T20 cricket. So England have got plenty of batting to come still. So it's not impossible. What is also not impossible is that we'll get some rain, because it has been. We've been very lucky today, actually, because it hosed it down yesterday in the northeast. And some of us were quite sceptical about whether we'd get anything more than a water polo game today, but it's drained really well, and it's been a really pleasant, quite cold but sunny afternoon at times. But we do think there might be a bit of rain on the horizon, so Duckworth Lewis Stern might come into consideration a bit later as well. But as things stand at the moment, 43 for 2 England after 10 overs, chasing 305 to win.
Great stuff. Anorak watchers will have a field day, Ellie. It does look a bit miserable sat in the crowd there, I must admit. Right, back to Ellie as and when. 5:22.
Yeah, we're here till 7. A lot still to come. We're going to be joined by one of the world's leading child psychologists. Really intrigued by this, as I've got a 3-year-old at home, Steve Bidulph. He is going to be telling us about his plans for tackling anxiety in young people. Steve, that is, not the 3-year-old. And Mariana Spring will join us to talk about her new BBC Sound series about the impact that social media is having on the US presidential election. Now, she's been finding out about some of the conspiracy theories surrounding the attempted assassination of Donald Trump.
They believe that it's a white hat operation, which was done to put Trump on the map to those who were not necessarily paying attention yet.
And it's like paying attention to what they then would call like the deep state and the bad stuff happening.
Right.
Yes, so much to ask Mariana today. This sort of thing absolutely fascinates me. And you can hear more about that after 6:30.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, a former chief executive of Harrods, James MacArthur, has told the BBC he witnessed abhorrent behaviour from the shop's former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, but denied being aware of any sexual abuse. Dozens of women have now said they were sexually assaulted or raped by Mr. Al-Fayed. He died last year. Harrods has previously said the women were failed and it would settle legal claims as soon as possible. The company also said it was investigating whether any current staff had been involved. Eloisa Crichton is a partner at Denton Solicitors and a specialist in employment and equality law. Eloisa, hello to you.
Hi there.
What's your assessment of the way Harrods are approaching this?
Yeah, well, it looks like what they're doing is focusing on trying to understand not just what happened in the past, but also what their culture is like now. Do they have an existing problem that might lead to either further allegations of things that have happened historically, and also looking with an eye to the future to see, do they still have a problem with people being able to report things and feel safe, to understand that in order to create a safe working environment going forward, which I think is particularly important in light of these things that have come out recently.
When it comes to corporate responsibility for shocking issues like this, where does responsibility lie, assuming that there are a succession of takeovers and new owners in place? Are you historically liable for everything that's happened in the history?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. So the starting point is employers tend to be vicariously liable, so responsible for what their employees and officers do for things like this. But the question here, I think, relates to the fact that Harrods has changed hands. Now, don't know the specific circumstances of the Harrods deal, but if a company changes hands in a share sale environment, it means that although the employing entity is owned by new owners, it's still the same company. So from an employee perspective, I'm employed by Harrods before and I'm still employed by Harrods. So that company stays the same and there's still liability. What happens in relation to cases like this, though, is often that it's not the fact that the company's changed hands that makes a difference. It's the time that's passed since the circumstances that gave rise to the allegations took place. A lot of time has passed, and often that can mean that you can struggle to raise a legal claim because you have to do so within a certain window.
Right. Okay. However, when it comes to a brand and brand protection, Harrods is right up there, isn't it? So they, even if legally, I guess they're not liable, they will want to be seen to be doing the right thing.
Correct. So there's a big restorative justice piece to this. So we see that more and more these days where employers, especially those with a brand to protect, are looking not to get out of a claim on a technicality, but rather to say, what is the right thing to do here? Are we responsible? Does it make sense that we do something to try and restore the position as best you can? Of course, you can't go back in time, but what can they do and what should they do? And often that's a look back at what happened before, but also what do they want the perception of the brand to be going forward? And also, what can they learn and change going forward? Because obviously no company wants something like this to happen, but certainly once something has come into the media focus, if it happens again, then that feels worse almost, because they've been forewarned that there is an issue. So they'll be really moving now to try and make sure that there's not a repeat of any of these kind of types of incidents.
Right. So it's kind of a balancing act between legal advice and PR, really, isn't it, at the moment for them?
Certainly. And the other thing that's really relevant here is that we've got the new duty to proactively prevent sexual harassment in the workplace coming in on the 26th of October. So see, even if these incidents hadn't come to light, then like many big employers, they might be going through a process of risk assessing their business, identifying if there's any areas where harassment might be more likely and able to occur, and looking at steps to address that. And that's something we're seeing a lot of employers asking about. But particularly now, Harrods will be looking at thinking, okay, what can we do to make a safer working environment for
so
people.
It, from that, it sounds like you're saying, you know, it's prudent to say, to be able to come into and say, at least now our house is in order. So if I or anyone was taking over a company, how much historical research is done into issues, let's call them scandals, from the past, you know, unearthing the dirty washing kind of thing? Is that common for lawyers to dig back?
Yeah, so that's a big part of a role that lawyers would be brought in to do, and then we call it diligence. So you would, if someone was looking at buying a company, then what normally happens is they look into that to understand financially what's the company worth and then what's been going on. Part of that would be the employment diligence, and one strand of that might be looking at any historic claims or allegations or circumstances that might give rise to claims. So sometimes there's a question of how far you look back, and sometimes there might be information that's really not available or not known at the time. But the high level point that yes, before you buy a company, you would do some form of diligence to understand what has happened in the past, what risks are there. And then it's a commercial question about how that impacts maybe what you pay for the company or anything else that you might include in those documents relating to you buying the company.
But this is where this gets interesting, because I guess from a purely legal perspective, you would say, well, our risk ran out X many years ago because of liability to certain charges. But now, as we've already established, Harrods have this PR issue as well. So nothing will go away forever, it would seem.
Correct. Yeah, and you really, you can't, it's like a lot of things legally, you can't protect yourself against the bad press that might happen if something comes out. You know, once the horse is bolted, you can't kind of put it back. So there is a realization, I think, that you have to know if you're buying something, you want to be understanding not just is it a legal risk that might actually come to my door through the courts, or is it something that reputationally could be a problem, because that can have a massive impact for the brand, for the stakeholders and various people.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you hear that phrase due diligence, it's generally taken to mean financially and rather than reputational. That's really interesting. Eloisa, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Eloisa Crichton there from Denton's Solicitors. It is Drive with Holly and Tony. It's time for news and sport at 5:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And at 5:30, here are your BBC News headlines. Sir Keir Starmer has delivered his first speech as Prime Minister to the Labour Party conference, promising to rebalance the country for working people. He told delegates in Liverpool he would restore the belief of families that their children would grow up in a country that was getting better. Elsewhere, Israel says it has killed a senior Hezbollah commander in an airstrike in Beirut. The Israeli military said Ibrahim Mohammed Kabezi was the commander of the militant group's missile and rocket force, responsible for launching missiles into Israel. British Airways has suspended flights to and from Tel Aviv for tomorrow and Thursday. It said it's continually monitoring the situation in the Middle East and would be contacting customers to advise them of their travel options. DSB has apologised for a glitch which meant some account holders didn't receive their wages or benefits this morning. It says the problem is now fixed and all payments have been credited. And with all the cricket and all the rest of today's sport, Jonathan McKeith.
Holly, thank you. England have it all to do if they're to keep the one-day series alive against Australia. That's after losing two quick wickets in reply to Australia's 304/7. With the latest from Durham is Ellie Oldroyd.
And a ripple of applause, because the 50 is up for England in the 12th over, 50-2 with Will Jacks on 25 and Harry Brook on 14. But yes, as you say, that rebuilding had to happen after Phil Salt went for a duck and Ben Duckett for 8. But if these two can put a bit of a partnership together and then start to increase the rate, then England have still got a chance, you'd have thought, provided that the weather stays okay. And a streaky boundary for Will Jacks will take him on to 29 and England 54-2.
Ellie, thank you. Commentary on Five Sports Extra. Meanwhile, England fast bowler Mark Wood says he's been told by doctors to stop lifting his kids up with his right arm because of the elbow injury found during the test series against Sri Lanka last month. He was initially sidelined with a groin problem after complaining of soreness in his arm. Scans found bone stress in his right elbow, ruling him out for the rest of the year.
It's been a bit bizarre, really. There's nothing I can really do on my right side. I've been even told to stop picking my kids up with my right arm. I have to do everything with my left. So I'm hoping I'm going to come back a bit like Nadal with one big left arm and then this skinny right arm. But yeah, it was just a bizarre injury.
AFC Wimbledon say their pitches suffered significant damage after they were forced to pump over 100,000 litres of water out of the stadium at Plough Lane. A nearby river burst its banks on Sunday, forcing the FL Cup tie against Newcastle United, scheduled for tonight, to be called off and switched to St James's Park next week. The club says the stadium will remain closed until further notice. The club's managing director, James Rudroff, spoke to Drive.
It's impossible for us at this stage to say the investment that's going to be required. And yes, we do have insurance for the pitch and the stadium, and we're working really closely with our insurers at the moment.
Wimbledon fans have set up a Just Giving page to try to help the club with the repairs, and in less than 24 hours it has received more than half of its £100,000 target. Joe El Abd is close to becoming England men's rugby's new defence coach. El Abd is currently head coach of the French side Oyonnax. The former flanker is expected to be in place for the upcoming November internationals. And Britain's Fran Brown has defended her C1 individual time trial title at the Road Paracycling World Championships in Zurich.
A look at your travel news. Well, the M8 in Glasgow is still really slow. Now, this is because of repairs which are going on at Junction 13 near the M80 at Brabant. So westbound, two lanes are closed. And Manchester, it's extra busy tonight on some of those routes. East Manchester, of course, a lot of traffic. It's much traffic around heading for the Etihad. You've got the regional road looking busy near the M602 and heading east into the city centre looking busy as well on the M602. Busy traffic as well on the A628, the Woodhead Pass, that's heading into Manchester on that east side. A55. So North Wales Expressway near Eulo at Junction 34, that's where all traffic is at a stand. It's a service incident, apparently, emergency services incident. I've never heard of one of those, but something going on there, and stationary traffic on the approach. Now, the M4 in Berkshire is looking slow on the eastbound side. That's at Junction 6 at Slough. One lane down for a breakdown. The A2, there's a massive queue. It's westbound, heading towards London, and at the Falconwood interchange, it's completely blocked by an accident with the queues backing up to Bexley Heath, and on the opposite side, heading out of London. That's the A2. Tower Bridge in London is closed in both directions because of an accident. And the M3, heading south at Junction 11 at Winchester South. One of the lanes down there for emergency repairs. Warner Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
Coming up this week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 8, 5 Live has commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham. Today, there's ball-by-ball coverage of England against Australia in the third ODI on 5 Sports Extra.
And tonight at 8, Aston Villa travel to Wickham in the EFL Cup.
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds. The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Good evening, Tony and Holly here with you until 7 o'clock tonight. Lots to come. We will be getting the latest from Lebanon, of course. We'll also be hearing from the Australian author, activist and psychologist Steve Bidulph, 85058, if you do have any questions for him. He is an expert on raising kids. That's all I know about him, really, so I've got a few of my own, let me tell you. But just now, we're going to be speaking to Mariana Spring. Mariana, friend of the show, sometime Drive presenter, of course, about misinformation and all this kind of spread of hate that we see online. And it's something that has increased in recent months and years, you know, with the election in the US at the minute. It seems to be a real focus, particularly with two recent security breaches on the former President Donald Trump, including one which resulted in a failed assassination attempt in Pennsylvania. This new Radio 4 and BBC Science series is called Why Do You Hate Me, USA? Let's speak now to Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Oh, lovely to chat to you. Now, of course, this is the second series, but you've gone stateside with this one now. It is fascinating, and I'm really interested to hear the differences that you have found whenever you've gone across the pond, so to speak, and the different types of people that you've heard from. I know you met someone called Desiree in the very first episode. Tell me about Desiree.
I did, and you're totally right, Holly. There are some differences to navigating this social media world in the UK and the US, but there are actually quite a lot of similarities as well, because I've tended to find that the people who are drawn into this stuff, particularly online, and by stuff I mean disinformation, conspiracy theories, hate sometimes too, are often drawn to it by the same things. And what I decided to do for episode one was to track down two different women. They have quite different political views. They're similar in other ways. And they both live in Colorado, in the States. And I spent quite a lot of time initially with this woman you mentioned, Desiree, who also goes by the name of Wild Mother on social media. She posts lots of content online. She started initially posting about motherhood and natural medicine before her content evolved and she began sharing unproven theories about stuff that was unfolding behind the headlines and big news events. So everything from 9/11 to a bridge collapse that happened in Baltimore earlier that year and all sorts of stuff like that. And when the assassination attempt happened on Donald Trump in July, the one in Pennsylvania that you mentioned there, she found herself asking quite a lot of questions. She thought, oh, something's not right here. I don't know what's going on. She turned to her tribe, so to speak, on social media for answers. And she found herself falling down what we often call the rabbit hole. What started off as genuine questions about how did this happen and why did it happen, quickly spiraled into, right, this must be part of a plot. And not just that, but the belief that Donald Trump had actually staged the assassination in order to frame his enemies, which there's no evidence to support. Here is her explaining that to me.
They've already basically over these past 4 years have been doing covert operations behind the scenes as what they call the white hats, which are the good guys of the military that didn't want this to go on anymore.
And is that Trump's team, so to speak?
So to speak, yeah. So I think that they believe that it's a white hat operation, which was done to put Trump on the map to those who were not necessarily paying attention yet.
And it's like paying attention to what they then would call like the deep state and the bad stuff happening.
Right.
She's so sure, isn't she? You know, the way she's talking so resolutely about this, and that's something you do cover in the series, just how somebody like Desiree kind of falls into their own echo chamber, and they are so positive of these conspiracy theories that they're talking about them all, you know, in factual terms.
Holly, I should say as well that I was speaking to her barefoot in a waterfall, which feels very different to when I'm sometimes
speaking
on drive.
I think we have to explain that. Why were you barefoot in a waterfall?
Well, she sort of loves this waterfall and she goes there to kind of talk about nature and her little girl. She takes her there to play and stuff like that. And we went down to this waterfall and I was wearing probably not the right pair of shoes. And she said, I think you're going to need to take the shoes off. And I said, oh no. And I tried really hard and then I did have to take the shoes off and the water was very cold, but it makes for a good listen nonetheless.
It must be so bizarre to have these, I mean, because they're very serious conversations and you're meeting these sort of people that they live really interesting lives themselves and they put it all out there in social media. You also spoke to another woman as well, Camille, a longtime Democrat voter in Denver. It's very different from Desiree, though, because the July assassination attempt on Trump, well, that was the first time she'd ever thought something had been staged in a political context. Let's hear from her.
And what was your first reaction?
Oh, that's staged. That was my first reaction because the Secret Service, if they weren't involved in some sort of staged event, A, I don't think it would have happened, and B, they wouldn't have let him pose for a picture. No. And I just don't think that it's beyond him to sacrifice others for his own gain.
So this is where this idea of what happens, you know, that people have these thoughts and conspiracy theories and they put them out there in social media and that is kind of what molds the narrative. It's not just about we're viewing these things as a reaction. This is what you're dealing with in the program, that then is spread, that these ideas are shared by other people and then they influence other people and that's where we end up in this situation. And then you've got somebody like Camille who never thought that, you know, she would never have had these thoughts before, but it's she sees that other people feel that way too.
Exactly. And I think that's what's been so important about investigating this, because someone like Wild Mother Desiree, who everyone heard from just before this, she's no stranger to what we often call the conspiracy theory playbook, you know, suggesting stuff has been staged or that it was a hoax, it was all part of a plot or a plan. Whereas Camille is a newcomer to this. She had never posted anything like this before. She didn't think that the pandemic was staged or a hoax. She was really, really strongly opposed to false claims that the 2020 election in the States was rigged. And yet she finds herself using the same language that people who she really doesn't like online are using too. And in Camille's case, a lot of this happened because she doesn't feel like she can trust the media anymore. She had genuine questions about how this had happened and allegations of security failings. The head of the Secret Service actually left her position after that failed assassination attempt. And so she turns to X, what we used to call Twitter, mm-hmm. and there are loads of accounts she follows who also don't like Donald Trump very much, and she trusts them. And so when they're saying it's staged, and that is recommended by the algorithms to the top of her feed, you can see how she then starts to believe it, because that's who she trusts. And so you enter this kind of topsy-turvy world where someone like Camille, who really doesn't like Donald Trump, and someone like Wild Mother, who supports and likes Donald Trump, can believe the same thing. That he staged the assassination attempt, again, without any evidence to support that idea.
Yeah, just the idea that people can believe anything, you know, just if it's set up in a certain way. And I know you touch on other issues like AI, that's becoming such a big player within these elections and how they're being used, how that is being used in terms of the technology by the wrong people.
Yeah, we do. Each episode kind of explores different online phenomena, social media phenomena, and, you know, conspiracy theories and the hate and the threats that they can trigger as well are one part of that. But AI fakes and the damage they can do to local communities, especially when they seem to be secret recordings, when they make references to things that only someone on the inside could know, for example, like names of people involved and things like that, they can be particularly persuasive. That episode's the next one that will be coming out soon. And then we also explore other issues like hate and threats targeting students around the war in Gaza and the Hamas attacks on Israel too, and online fandoms. The Swifties have quite famously now thrown their support, or rather Taylor Swift has quite famously thrown her support behind Kamala Harris, who's running against Donald Trump for president. And those fandoms, particularly her fandom, which is a very vocal one online, could have a serious impact, or they could be, as they have a reputation for being, a little bit toxic too. So all of this is about unpicking, exactly like you say, Holly, how we maybe are wrong to think of it as the election happens on social media and we sort of follow it along there. Mm. Rather, what's unfolding in the social media world is constantly affecting and shaping what actually happens in the real world. They're kind of the same thing. And certainly what happens in the election, and to all of us, not just in the States really, but here in the UK too, which is why I got to hang out in Waterfalls, which was good.
I think the dangerous part is because people really can get hurt here. And I think that's the thing that you address in this series, the idea that it's not just words. And you talk there about, you know, those students, and you also met people who were working on the elections in Colorado and hearing firsthand about those threats. You spoke to Coy Ung, who operates the vote sorting systems. Let's hear a clip from him.
I think as an election worker, we are kind of the front lines, right? You know, post the results of 2020, myself and my colleagues have been targeted with harassment, accusations of us doing nefarious things. I don't tell a lot of the public that I'm in elections unless the conversation drives it that way. I generally tell just, you know, random strangers that I'm just in IT.
I mean, that's a guy working in IT who is getting threats on his life because of his work, because of conspiracies.
Exactly. And you know, he's someone who never would have imagined when he first got into doing this. He runs this machine that they fondly call HAL in this election centre in Jefferson County, which is also in Colorado, where those two women live who we heard from. And, you know, he loves this machine, and he showed me how it all worked and how it sorts out the ballots. It's named after HAL from Space Odyssey, where the machine becomes evil and, like, turns against its owner and stuff like that. I don't think that's what HAL is going to do. However, what I think is really important for us to understand is the impact that it can have when people believe almost anything and everything can be staged or rigged without the evidence to support it. And, you know, people believing that the assassination attempts were staged feeds into this wider narrative that can happen, and that elections in particular can be rigged. And that has a consequence for the kinds of people who are trying to uphold some of the institutions, or, you know, democracy, for example, in the case of the election workers.
Yeah.
They find themselves getting really, really nasty extreme hate. And the two women I spoke to, Camille and Wildmother, I don't think they'd send threats like that, but other people who subscribe to that way of thinking can and do. And what we enter is this kind of social media world, this conspiracy land, as I often call it, where hate can feel justified because you really believe this stuff. So you think you need to send it. And that's the worry, I think, heading up to November.
Yeah, and it all feeds off each other. Marianna Spring, great to chat to you as always. A really interesting listen. You can listen to the first two episodes of Why Do You Hate Me USA on BBC Sounds 9.
I was just going to congratulate Marianna on a new series.
I've lost track. It's number 100.
Is it?
Joking.
Yeah. No. Nice to meet
you,
Marianna.
Thank you for having me.
See
you. All the best.
Bye. Right, let's go to Elder Oldroyd. The Mexicans are signalling four in the crowd. The spinners are on. It's all happening at Chesterley Street, Ellie.
Yeah, but it's not raining though, Tony. We were looking at the weather forecast and we thought it might be raining by now, but it is not. And England are going along not too badly, actually. This partnership between Will Jackson and Harry Brook is still going. The 82 for two at the moment. Target is 305. And between the two of them, they put on 71 runs for the third wicket. So they are doing their job at the moment, Will Jackson. Jacks and Harry Brook. And they've also upped the rate a bit. I was saying they needed to just kind of keep an eye on the run rate. Current run rate is 5.29, so 6.5 they need to get it up to, but they've accelerated over the last few overs. So if they can stay together, if they can keep on going, and if they don't get too cold, they're out there with short sleeves on, the two of them, yeah. Too. So I have to say that in the commentary box that we sit in here at Chesterless Street, our colleague from Radio Newcastle, Martin Emerson, said, "I know how to put the central heating on." So we've had the central heating on in the commentary box here, which I think is the first time I've had that at a match during the cricket season.
Cricket in England for you in the modern
Absolutely.
Era.
Absolutely. 84 for two, Tony, after 15 overs.
Cheers, LA. Back shortly. Thank you.
That'll be me. I'd be putting the central heating on during the cricket. Right, OK, we've got just over an hour left on the show. We've got lots more to get through, including the latest from Lebanon. Of course, the country has been in the headlines for the past few days, but its relationship with its neighbour Israel has been a really difficult and often violent one for decades now. So while the situation there is continuing to get worse, we'll try and give you a guide to their shared history. That's coming up after six.
Yeah, and Lebanon, as you would imagine, is one of the subjects that world leaders are discussing in New York. They're gathering for the UN General Assembly. Joe Biden's already mentioned it in his opening address.
Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest. Even if the situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is still possible. In fact, it remains the only path to lasting security to allow the residents from both countries to return to their homes and the border safely. That's what we're working tirelessly to achieve.
Yep. Also on the agenda, Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan as well. President Biden spoke regarding Ukraine. He said, "We cannot grow weary. We cannot turn away." So we'll talk about the UN General Assembly as well before the end of the programme.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live,
the voice of the UK.
5 Live Drive. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, welcome to the show, Australian author, activist and psychologist Steve Biddulph. His parenting books have sold millions of copies. They've been translated into 32 different languages. His new book, Wild Creature Mind, looks at the world's worst mental health crisis and what can be done about the growing number of people growing up with anxiety and poor mental health. Hello, Steve.
Hello there, Tony. Nice to talk to you and everyone listening.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Steve, it's interesting, the book, because I shouldn't open an interview about your book with the mention of another book, but Chimp Paradox set the agenda up many years ago, and I read that and found it really useful. And I've read your book and I found it really useful as well, in the sense of there is a lot of anxiety around today, isn't there? And people need help. That is an absolute starting point. Why are we so anxious at the moment, Steve, before we talk about your methods?
Yes, well, the understanding in the book, and I should explain that all of my books going way back to Raising Boys and those others, they're not my ideas. What I do is I get the message out. And there was this wonderful breakthrough started happening about 15 years ago in neuroscience, where they began to understand that we had not been using our brains properly. And anxiety is basically caused by too much thinking going on in one side of your brain and not using the other side of your brain to restore balance and harmony. And I gave that the name Wild Creature Mind, because calling it cerebral hemisphere body communication, this wasn't quite
catchy,
lively enough.
Catchy, no. Yeah. Well, so explain to us then the theory here, because I absolutely get the logic when I read about what you say. So just give it to us in quite simplistic terms, if you can, then, this theory of
sure.
Two sides of the brain.
Sure. Well, you and I are talking to each other, and we're using words to do that. And so it's my left brain talking to your left brain and everyone listening in their left brain. But at the same time, the right brain, your animal mind, my right brain is kind of checking out yours, and it's reading things like, can I trust you? Am I talking too quickly? Are we getting the dance right of this conversation? And people listening to us now are sort of working out the same thing. Can we trust this guy, Steve? Is he making sense? And so we've got the two parts of us continuously interacting, and the wild creature mind is so interesting because it's very, very smart. There was a British neuroscientist called Ian McGilchrist who figured this out, that we'd been totally wrong. We thought emotions lived across on that side of our brain. But it's actually more smart and more, in many ways, more steady and calm. And so if you're wanting to help someone with anxiety, what you do is you guide them across to their silent side of their mind, which speaks through the body. And so I worked with someone recently who had terrible sort of frozen grief from losing his wife in really severe circumstances. And we could have talked for hours, but what I instead did was say, as we're talking now, where in your body, what's happening in your body? And he immediately knew. He said, look, there's like a stone in my throat. I feel like my throat is like a cold rock. And I invited him to just be with that and make it welcome, not try and push it away or anything. And as we sat there, he just felt it sort of growing. And then all of a sudden, he just collapsed into sobbing tears, which he hadn't been able to do. And if he'd gone to a psychologist in the traditional mold, they would have talked and talked and talked. But the body method of getting to the heart of a problem is a very rapid guide, and it uses the right hemisphere's kind of knowledge, which is much more kind of big picture.
Right.
Does that make sort of sense?
Yeah, but the logic's there, but I'm wondering where it begins, because is it all based on instincts then? Are these emotions that we've had since humans first came out of the swamp and society has kind of, covered them up, for want of a better phrase?
Yes. Ian McGilchrist thinks that we became a left hemisphere society, and the left hemisphere always looks for what it can get out of things, and it breaks things into pieces and kind of exploits them. And that's okay if it's a bird, just hunting a worm, that's fine. But with people with anxiety, what they find, and I have exactly the same thing, you're lying in bed and your thoughts go round and round and round. And there's a really neat trick which you can use, Tony, which is to say, in those old Jane Austen books, people used to say there's a part of me that yearns for the sea, or the part of me that wants to give him a good smack in the mouth, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you feel anxiety, you wake up in the night and you're anxious, say to yourself, not I am anxious, but there's a part of me that's anxious, and then locate where it is. Is it in your tummy churning around? Is it kind of a clench around your heart? And as you do that, you'll find there's a kind of spaciousness starts to happen. Yes, I've got those symptoms, but it's not all of me. And then if you start to try and describe in words what the sensation is like, it's a kind of a clenching, or it's a kind of a hard core or something, what'll happen is your left brain will start talking to your right, because you're applying words to your body. And it's like the wild creature side of you feels noticed, and it starts to come out of the thickets of your mind, and it will start to soften.
Right.
Yes.
Well, yeah, obey your instincts to a certain extent. But what you're offering, Steve, are solutions here. But it's quite interesting to me to find the cause of how society has got to this point. And what I think what you're saying is, we ain't happy with the way we're being forced to live our lives at the moment. It's all about achievement. It's all about success. It's all about, look at me, I've done so well. When actually our body's just saying, can we be happy for once?
That sums it up very well. And so, with our kiddies, we can teach them, because what happens when you go to your wild creature mind, which is what an animal would be just naturally in as it's, walking through the jungle or flying in the air, it's open. It's very receptive. You can tell when you're in this side of your mind, because it goes kind of soft and it's alert and ready. I describe it in the book like, it's like a panther just padding along beside you, but it's there and it's everything you need to protect you. Sometimes it's a little hamster just wanting to curl up and be looked after. And we find that kids with big anxiety problems really get this, Tony. They can relate to it, and they can start to find that there's the girl in the book, Ellie, is at the start of the book, basically on the point of being hospitalized with anxiety, turns out to discover that she's actually, furiously angry with the way that boys are treating her in the town she lives in and her friends. So she goes from anxious to furious. And so sometimes it'll guide you to what your true picture is. And it's not a sedative. It's not something, you know, people say, be mindful, be calm. It helps you to gain a kind of resolve and get a handle on where you want to go next.
Yeah.
So it's a brilliant resource.
I'm a fairly recent convert to this kind of thinking. That one sentence that struck a real chord with me and has lived with me now for a while is you don't always have to listen to your brain. It's not necessarily right all the time, and you need to use it a little bit more. Do you think we've reached a point? Because there are cynics out there. They'll be there, Steve, now listening to this, going, "We didn't have this in my day. No mental pressures and anxiety when I were a kid, but obviously we did." But do you think this is society's way of getting a grip? Because wouldn't we all love a society that where people were happier and not as bent on just achievement as an aim? Because often that's an empty achievement anyway, isn't it? You get something that you've wanted for 10 years, and when you get it, you don't want it, you want something else.
Yes, I think finding what really makes us happy is very important, and what we usually want is we want connection and calmness and to be in the beauty of being alive, and so a big concern of mine, of course, is family violence, and very often what drives family violence again is anxiety. A man feels he can't control his family, and so he lashes out. Whereas, in fact, his family would probably love it if he was just a whole calmer man to be around, and he was there and played with his children and sat quietly with his wife and enjoyed having a lovely partner. And so if we can, I think anxiety is the second biggest problem on the planet. Obviously, climate change is the biggest, but anxiety shows that we have misunderstood our minds, and psychology hasn't helped because it's gone into much more talking around. And so the new therapies and the ideas in the book are saying your body is your friend. Wow. And it's really wanting to help you and got things to teach you.
Steve, anxiety not helped by the Five Life Stress Med playing under you, trying to keep us all calm. Thanks for being with us.
Lovely to talk. Thank you.
Steve Biddulph, author of Wild Creature Mind.
Fascinating.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
And at 6 o'clock, let's get your BBC News headlines. And Sir Keir Starmer has said things will be tough for the short term, but will be worth it in the long term during his speech to the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. The Prime Minister has said he'll lead a great reforming government that'll improve the economy, tackle welfare fraud and reduce energy bills. He's been trying to counteract recent negative messaging about the economy and criticism for scrapping winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. Here's the BBC's Deputy Political Editor, Vicky Young.
I think there was, you know, a bit of a recalibration, certainly in the tone. We've had a lot of people here, you know, worried about the doom and gloom, obviously warning that it's going to be very difficult. But, you know, there was a bit more hope, really. It was a sort of state of the nation, talking about national renewal, but saying it's going to take a very long time and that there will be some tough decisions in the short term.
President Biden has told the UN General Assembly that a diplomatic solution to the conflict in the Middle East is still possible, despite intense strikes between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel says it has killed one of the militant group's senior commanders with an airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Civilians have been fleeing the attacks, with Israel saying it warned civilians to leave areas close to Hezbollah sites. UNICEF says people there are in need of basic necessities. Edouard Begbeth is its Lebanese representative.
UNICEF is distributing here blankets, hygiene kits, mattresses and providing some water. What struck me is naturally all the stories of the mothers and the children and the way they had to flee their houses. Most of them have left in a few minutes. Some of them have seen their house being destroyed.
Two men aged 52 and 18 have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a 15-year-old boy was stabbed to death in southeast London. The Metropolitan Police have named the boy who died in Woolwich as Dejuan Campbell. The number of people in Scotland living in temporary accommodation because of homelessness has reached a record high. As of March this year, more than 16,000 people